All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuck nicks? What's happening? I am Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. It's been okay the last few days. I don't know how up to speed those of you tuning in are with where I'm at, but I am within the grief tunnel. It's coming up on 2 months on Saturday since Lynn Shelton passed away. And it's something is changing. How are you guys? Look, I'm not going to make a life out of grief, but it seems, I seem to be, in it and monitoring it and feeling the feelings. But I don't want to neglect you guys. I don't want to forget to tell you that on the show today, Helen Mirren is here, Oscar, Emmy, BAFTA, and Tony Award-winning actress. The amazing Helen Mirren, the stunning and profoundly talented Helen Mirren. She's on this HBO thing, this Catherine the Great limited series, but she's been in a lot of stuff. And I actually watched her, I was kind of going through her stuff, and I realized she was in an old movie that I saw when it came out at the Art House in Albuquerque, New Mexico. It was called Long Good Friday. It was a relatively contemporary, I guess it was a probably the early 80s, a modern English gangster movie with Bob Hoskins. And she's the female lead, and she's great. But Hoskins, is just to work with that guy, just what an animal, man. Just, fierce, fucking seething presence. There aren't that many seething presences. But I was lucky. I was fortunate. It was on the Criterion Channel, which I watch. And I'm going to watch Lola, and that completes the trilogy of whatever that was. Veronica Voss, The Marriage of Maria Braun, and Lola, the Fassbender movies. I didn't know it was a trilogy. But I talked to my buddy Tracy Letts. Yeah, I'll drop a couple names. He's been very nice to me during this time of sadness, talking me through it. He's experienced something similar in his life. It's been very helpful. I might give him a call tonight even. Staying in touch with the people. That's the hard stuff. The hard part about the grieving is that, it's the aloneness a bit. But Tom Sharpling came over for dinner the other night, and I've been hiking with my pal Al Madrigal, going up the hill, talking about stuff, gossiping a little bit. Things get limited, and everybody's not doing much. The gossip and the what you can talk about. There's not a lot of fresh news around, and in terms of the macro, that can't that's never good anymore. It's fucking paralyzing out here. Just managing the existential despair and terror of whatever the fuck is happening, and just watching people snap. It's amazing the consistency of these belligerent, ignorant dum-dums who just refuse to take care of themselves or others by really simply wearing a dumb mask indoors so as they don't get sick and they don't get others sick with this thing escalating. But some of these people have they're going to die on this hill, man. This was the freedom fight that they were going to fight, this mask business. And when they lose it, I've watched 3 or 4 videos of women in supermarkets and Target stores, and I just watched one of a guy. I've watched 2 of a guy. It is literally like watching, and I don't have children, but I'm thinking a 3 to 5 year old temper tantrum in the body of a grown person ranting and raving about it usually doesn't even make sense. It's just like something snaps in their head, and it has to do with a mask, and it represents a lot of things. Freedom, God, didn't intend it. It's just a confusion of conspiratorial garbage and right-wing talking points and some Christian end times business just mashed up in sort of just kind of blurts. And usually there's a physical activity, a childish physical activity, throwing groceries on the floor, taking things off a rack. Something snaps inside these people, and I think you really get to see who they are emotionally at the core of whatever ideological insanity they've allowed their brain to be programmed with. And it's like three to 5 years old. And I would imagine intellectually, some of them close to that as well. And I don't want to be condescending, but just watch those things. This is not grown-up behavior. It's just, it's like, you know, just stubborn children being told to do something healthy and just like, no, no, no. Very exciting. I acknowledged, oddly, but I acknowledged the passing of Ronnie and Donnie Galleon, I believe is how you say their last name. Ronnie and Donnie Galleon of Beaver Creek, Ohio. The oldest, the longest surviving conjoined twins. I guess they died July 4th. I did not know it was that many days ago. And the reason I brought attention to it is I wouldn't say they traumatized me because I bought the ticket. And I think expanded my brain, but blew a hole in it for sure. When I was younger, some of you know this, I had a mild obsession with the circus or the sideshow, the Midway sideshow, the circus freaks, as they were called, human anomalies, as Joel Peter Witkin would call them. But I couldn't understand my fascination with them. I had books about them. And I think it was really just that they were terminally and, you know, tragically, some of them unique by birth, some by choice, but the ones by birth were more fascinating to me. Yet they figured out a way to exist. And I think it spoke to something inside me that I felt so uncomfortable that going to the New Mexico State Fair, nervously buying a ticket to walk up a ramp to a viewing window in a trailer to look at Ronnie and Donnie sitting in there, just watching television with their flesh of conjoinment and whatever organs they shared exposed, that they seemed comfortable. They were watching television. They didn't seem to mind us looking at them, but they didn't put on a show. They were just there, and it was inspiring to me. I mean, outside of the fact that they were, I don't know what their life looked like, but in the trailer they seemed comfortable, and it was quite a decent racket. They didn't have to do much. I mean, they were already conjoined. I mean, I guess they could do more, but they really didn't put a lot of effort into it. They were just sitting there. I think maybe one of them was having a snack, watching television. But the way they moved and the way they sort of, it was just, I think it made me feel better that there was a place in the world for everybody. And, you know, oddly, my place was on stage as well. I was not in a trailer. I don't have a conjoined twin, but I have a sort of hidden emotional obesity that I stuffed down. And in another note, I noticed that there was a tweet that my producer, Brendan McDonald, forwarded me that it says, Japan's theme parks have banned screaming on roller coasters because it spreads coronavirus. And quote, please scream inside your heart, unquote. And I'm familiar with that. I'd like, you want to know what screaming inside your heart sounds like? I'm doing it now. I'm doing it most of the time. I've mastered it. Did you hear it? No, right? It's happening. I'm screaming inside my heart right now. Every morning I get up and I actually pray to nothing for a little peace of mind and a little guidance. Pray to nothing. I pray to no one. I pray to humble myself and let go of the chains and pain in my heart, to stop screaming in my heart for a minute or two and ground myself in something larger that remains unidentified. I'm not paying any lip service to any sort of higher power. It's just a way of humbling and trying to kind of like try to get a valve, release valve on the sadness. And then I spend a couple minutes looking at a picture that of me and Lynn that she seemed to like. And then, you know, I deal with my cats. Monkey hanging on, getting frail. But I think, you know, I don't know, he seems okay. The best thing that can happen, I think, at this point is that he just dies in his sleep. Buster is fat, getting fat. I don't know if he's sick, too. He seems to run around like he's a kitten, but he's fat, and he gets himself out of breath. And he beats up on fucking Monkey. But I seem to have some acceptance around that. I'm no longer seeing, you know, Monkey's aging and near-deathness as part of some kind of heartbreaking continuum that that has been, you know, imposed upon me, that I've been drawn into by death and dying. And again, I want to thank everybody for reaching out. Still very happy that you're doing that. So Helen Mirren was recently, as I said earlier, in the HBO limited series Catherine the Great. You can watch that now, right now, on all HBO streaming and on-demand platforms. She's also in the upcoming The One and Only Ivan, which will be on Disney Plus next month. And this is me and Helen Mirren coming right up. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. I feel like as time goes on, because of texting, I'm losing pronouns. I no longer use a lot of words that I should use to communicate when I write.
I've kind of gone the opposite direction, I think. I've become very formal. Full stops, you know, capital letters.
On texting?
Yeah, totally. Oh, even more on texting. On texting, I'm like very rigid.
Well, that's that must be a real pleasure for the people who receive your texts.
And then it's probably boring. They go, oh, God, you know, get on with it.
Yeah. Don't text her. It'll be forever. You'll just get an entire novel. Where are you?
I mean, we're in Tahoe, actually.
Oh, that's close.
Brilliantly. And luckily, we just finished building a house here. And we just made the move from L.A. literally 6 months before the lockdown happened.
Oh
my God, we got locked down in the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful places.
So you're right on the lake, kind of?
Not right on, but I can see it from here, you know.
Oh, that's pretty.
The trees.
Are you happy?
It's really pretty. And, you know, incredible air and just endless entertainment by wildlife, you know.
What do you see?
Chipmunks and golden mantles and squirrels and about 10 different kinds of birds. I saw a bear the other day.
Really?
Great big black bear came by and stole all my bird food.
Oh, really?
So I went out and I said, bad bear, bad, naughty bear, very naughty bear. And he sort of looked at me and lumbered off. It was a big black bear.
That didn't scare him too quickly?
Well, fun funnily enough, you know, I was just reading a book, a little pamphlet about, you know, wildlife up here. And they said, and they were saying what to do if you encounter a bear and it's looking aggressively at you and hunching its back and looking like it's about to charge.
Yeah.
And they said, you make yourself look as big as possible. If you can, grab a stick, make yourself look big. And then it literally said, and then shout, bad bear, bad bear. So I can't wait to meet a bear and shout bad bear at it.
It seems like something that you might have done on stage before.
Well, there is of course that famous stage instruction in Shakespeare, which is exit followed by a bear.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And there's no enter a bear. He doesn't say enter a bear, or the bear doesn't take part in the scene. It's just this stage direction, exit pursued by a bear.
Rapidly, that means. I must, yeah. Yes, well, I mean, exactly. You've dealt with, like, it's funny because I feel like I've known you my whole life because I've seen you in things. But, like, for some reason, when I went back and watched the other night, speaking of, you know, acting with bears, is that I watched Long Good Friday.
Oh, yes. Yes. My dear little bear. Yes.
And he, like,
yes, Bob.
Right. But that scene where you have to calm him down and tell him to get hold of himself. I mean, that was like trying to stop a bear.
Yes, it's true. And Bob had this incredible ability to sort of look like he was a kettle about to explode or yeah. something, you know, you know, something you put in the microwave and you should have taken the lid off, but it's just about to completely explode.
Yeah.
He was brilliant at communicating that sort of explosive thing.
It's sort of a great movie. I had seen it when it came out when I was in high school, and I remember it being sort of a bleak movie. That ending is a little rugged.
Fabulous, yes.
Right,
Pierce Brosnan,
right,
the Irish guy. Pierce,
yeah, no lines. A young Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah, it was an iconic movie at the time. You know, many sort of British gangster movies followed on after that one, but that really was a trailblazer in the sense of the sort of British gangster movies. Brilliantly written by Barry O'Keefe, who very sadly very recently died, but it was an amazing piece of literature. And you know, what's amazing in that movie too, if you know London, is what was being proposed in that movie, which was the development of the East End, the Thames, on the east side of London, is exactly what happened. You know,
yeah.
Canary Wharf was built,
right,
and all of those flats. Millions of flats were built, apartments were built along down there. That whole area has become completely developed exactly in the way that Long Good Friday was talking about. So the landscape that we shot on when we made that movie in Eastern London has changed completely.
Of course.
If you go down there now, it's a completely different view.
Do you keep a place there? Are you connected to London?
Yes. Yes, and actually that's where I live, actually down in Wapping, yes.
Yeah.
Just a few yards from where we shot a lot of Long Good Friday, actually.
What part of London did you grow up in?
Well, actually, I didn't grow up in London. I was born in London.
And then you
so
went.
So I'm a Londoner. But we moved out to a sort of dormitory town. I explain it to Americans by saying I grew up in Coney Island. But because that was the kind of place, right. Southend-on-Sea is down on the Thames estuary. It's where the East Enders traditionally would go for a fun weekend, which consisted of eating fish and chips or cockles or winkles, getting drunk, having a fight, throwing up and going home. That was the tradition in the 50s.
Was there a roller coaster? Any roller coasters?
Oh, there was roller coasters. I used to work in the amusement park called the Curzel.
You did?
I did, yes. I blagged. Do you know what blagging is?
No, you're going to tell me, though, I think.
Blagging is when you sort of shout something incomprehensible out to someone just to get their attention and to bring them over to your stall, you know.
Oh, we have a we have a president that's doing that every day.
We do, absolutely. He belongs in an amusement park.
Yeah, he's one of the greatest blaggers of our lifetime.
Yes, yes, he has afforded a lot of laughs, I have to say. And a lot of fear. And
yeah,
horror,
monster.
But quite a few laughs too.
So you used to work at what amusement did you work at? What was the where did you?
Well, I worked on the dart stall when I worked there. So my job was to get people over just to get their money to play darts and give them a horrible little
toy,
yeah. You know, thing.
Why'd you end up there? Why did your family live there? Your parents just...
Well, you know, because my parents worked in the East End. They met in the East End. My dad actually used to, many, before, he was a musician, but he couldn't make, it was very difficult to make money at that. And as a very young man, he worked for a Jewish tailor. And the East End was traditionally, at that period, was where the Jewish community, the immigrant Jewish community, lived in the East End. So there was a wonderful old tradition of Jewish delicatessens and Jewish businesses in the East End. And one of those businesses was tailoring. And my dad actually worked for a Jewish tailor in the East End. And my mum was an East Ender. She came from West Ham.
And were they mostly, because your father immigrated as well, right?
My father was Russian, born in Russia.
Were most of the Jews, were the Jews mostly Russian or Polish, or did he?
The Jews were, yes, a lot of them were Eastern European Jewish people, of course, absolutely. You know, escaping from the ghettos of Poland and.
So I wonder, did your father speak?
Yeah,
did your father speak Yiddish or
no,
Polish?
No, my father wasn't Jewish. My father was a white Russian.
But he was working for him, so I thought maybe.
But
he
was, yeah, that's true. I bet he picked up a few Jewish words. Yes, absolutely.
But he spoke Russian, huh?
He spoke Russian, yes.
Did you speak Russian?
Language, yes. No, sadly not. I think my father was very, he came at the age of two. And at that time, the revolution was so entrenched that there wasn't any possibility of ever going back. So he very much wanted to assimilate. So as soon as he could, he changed our name from Mironov, which was my original name, to Miron. And we were not brought up speaking Russian.
Your father, what was his instrument?
The viola. Oh. He was a musician. Yeah.
Was he good?
Yes, he was. One of my earliest memories. Well, I don't know if he was good. I have no idea. I think that he gave it up because he realized he was never going to be a sort of, you know, star soloist.
Yeah.
He was always going to be in the orchestra sort of thing. And also, of course, the Second World War intervened and stopped his musical career completely. But my first memories are of him playing the viola, me waking up in the morning and hearing him practicing playing the viola.
So when the war came, do you remember? I mean, when was that? Because I've talked to some.
No, that I was born after the end of the war, so I don't.
So it's not. It's not in your memory.
Not in my memory, no. But you know, I asked my mom a lot about it. I couldn't imagine what it must have been like to have.
Oh, yeah, just rubble.
Coming
I mean,
every night. And my dad worked as an ambulance driver in the war, which was a very difficult emotion. It must have been physically very difficult. He couldn't join the services. He wanted to join the services, but he had some medical condition, maybe a bone spur. But I think it was a bit more serious than that. And he wasn't allowed to join the military. So instead, he drove an ambulance throughout the war in London through the Blitz.
Oh, my God.
And so that means pulling children out of rubble.
Right.
You know, terrible, terrible sights you must have seen.
I know. I can't. It's really astounding to me when you talk about, when any of us talk about or know people that have done these sort of almost unbelievable horrific jobs or tasks, and they just do it. And just by knowing what we go through in the modern world, or what we see on TV, or the limited amount of exposure we have to that kind of trauma and horror, I mean, just a little bit of it will blow your mind.
Absolutely, yeah.
To live in it, I mean, I can't imagine what they carry with them.
I think it's really hard, and it's hard for my generation to comprehend what my parents' generation went through.
Yeah.
You know, a depression before the Second World War, the rise of fascism, the coming of the Second World War, the endurance of the Second World War, the realization of what Stalin was doing in Russia, and the realization of the Holocaust.
Right.
To have to psychologically deal with all of those things and kind of carry on life and have children. You know, I was born at the end of the Second World, after the end of the Second World War, but I was conceived during the Second World War when all of this was going down.
Well, I can understand that. I mean, like, you know, what else are you going to do?
In terms of human contact.
Right.
But the thought of bringing children into this world, do you know what I mean?
I don't know how people do it now. I mean, I don't know.
Me neither.
Because all those things that you're talking about, you know, sadly, we're on the precipice of a generation seeing similar things, you know, in the world.
Yes, we are. It's true. Absolutely.
And like, I have friends who are younger than me. I was never wired for children. I like them, but I'm much too, you know, panicky and selfish to deal with it. So I don't have
it. Me too. Count me in. I mean, thank God I have stepchildren, and I'm incredibly grateful for the mothers of those stepchildren who've gone through all of that and just given me the pleasure of having stepchildren. I'm with you, Mark.
I don't know how people do it. I mean, and it's like,
it's
seemingly natural. And it's really not that I have anything against kids. It's just like, if you give me 2 minutes, I can get anxiety and panic about the children I don't have, like about the children I might have had. You know, just thinking about it overwhelms me with, I can't do it. I can't.
Do you have nieces and nephews?
I do. I got a few.
Yeah. That's nice, isn't it? That's a nice relationship.
Sure, you know,
you can be the naughty uncle.
Right, right.
I bet you are the naughty uncle.
I am. Yeah. I you know, the one they come to when they're in trouble of some kind, a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The one they can talk to. One of the first things I did for my nephew, I gave him a leather jacket at the age
good.
Of six.
You know? Good.
A really cool biker jacket.
Yeah.
I gave it to him. It was new. My sister was absolutely horrified. And I said, now this is what you do with a leather jacket. And I took it, I threw it on the ground, and I jumped on it.
Got it all messy.
My sister was going, don't do that with a new jacket. But that's the sort of thing you can do when you're the naughty.
Yeah, I don't see him enough, but you know, I'm okay. There's never a day that goes by where I regret not having children.
No, me neither. I have to say, I'm with you.
Your father, though, like, you know, you're saying about, you know, really thinking about that generation. I mean, did you sense, what were his politics like? What did he carry with him after that or through that?
Well, my dad, you know, he came from sort of aristocratic, you know, minor aristocratic, not aristocratic, but posh upper class.
Yeah.
Russian background.
His mother
was a countess. And
oh, wow.
He was born on the Russian estates that were then taken by the Bolsheviks. You know, he was a young man in London before watching the rise of fascism. And as so many young people were, it's the original Antifa group who were fighting against the rise of fascism in London. And there was a famous march in East London by Oswald Mosley, who was the sort of English fascist who wanted England to combine with Germany, Hitler, and become a fascist nation, basically. Hmm. And they had their black shirts, I think they were, walking through the Jewish quarter of the East End. And my father went on the so-called riot, or the peaceful demonstration against this fascist march. So his politics were left-wing as a young man. I think any young, intelligent person in the 1930s was left-wing. It was the rise of the unions, the rise of the concept of sort of a world where people without money could get an education. For example.
So that's what you grew up in.
The rise of the wealth. So I grew up in that sort of world, absolutely.
So he was a musician and a leftist and an intellectual and somebody who was engaged politically.
But also, my mum was a working class girl, intelligent, left school at 14, you know, the 13th of 14 children.
Oh, my God.
Absolutely. Talking of having children. That's, can you imagine?
That must have been what
did it. I
think
at that point, you just don't really think about it anymore, probably. Yeah. I don't know.
It's like that scene in the Monty Python's The Meaning of Life where Terry Jones is washing the dishes and a baby just plops out from under the couch.
Yes, exactly. That must be my grandmother on my mum's side.
Right.
No, she was working class, exactly. Economically, financially, we were very working class in the sense, and my dad finished up being a taxi driver, in fact. He did the knowledge. Do you know what the knowledge is?
No.
Doing the knowledge is what London cabbies have to do to become a licensed black cab driver in London.
It sounds it sounds like an important thing.
It isn't. Well, what they do is they learn every street in London. They have to learn literally the name of and where every street is in London.
Do they
is.
Still?
Yes, they still do. They still do the knowledge. GPS now, maybe eventually the knowledge will disappear, but it still is in existence. And then when they do the test, they say, okay, it's 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the afternoon.
Right.
You have to get from this street in North London to this street in South London. Describe me your route. And so the knowledge is that you have to say, okay, I turn left on St. James's Street, and then I turn right on Thursday Street.
And you have to take in consideration the traffic.
The traffic, exactly.
Oh,
so that's the knowledge. And when you pass that, then you get that's why London cabbies are amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I really advise anyone they're more money now, but they are, London cabbies are incredible.
I don't think I've been educated that well in anything that I do. Like
you go on instinct. That's pretty good as well. You know, that works.
Well, I guess like what I was getting at is that there was at least an environment where it seems like they were encouraging of the arts, I'm assuming.
They were. I mean, we couldn't financially, I didn't go to, we didn't have television. We didn't go to the cinema, actually.
No?
We didn't go to the theater. Well, no, financially, literally, we couldn't afford.
Well, how did you decide to be, to pursue acting?
I'll tell you what happened. I saw an amateur production of Hamlet. This, the one time my mum, apart from this, I'd only ever seen shows at the end of the pier, which I loved.
Well, what kind of shows were those?
Oh, you know, show you have girls come on dancing.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely wanted to be one of those girls. And then the comedian came on and he made me literally fall off my seat with laughing. It was a variety show, end of the pier variety show. And that was my first experience of the theatre. And I remember it to this day.
Who was the comedian?
I absolutely loved it. He was a guy called Terry Scott. He was an English comedian. You look him up when we finish.
Okay.
Terry Scott.
Okay.
S-C-O-T-T.
Got it.
And he was the guy who was at the end of the pier when I saw my first theater.
Why isn't that the name of a play? The End of the Pier. Somebody should write that show.
Yes, they should. And
I love what it means, because I would never like that. And that was something people knew, that there was a show at the end of the pier. That's where you see.
Yeah.
The show. I love
South End, my hometown, was famous. Well, it wasn't famous at all for this, but it has the longest pier in the world. It does have the longest pier in the world. It's a mile and a quarter long, and you have to take a little train out.
Is it still there?
I think it is still there.
So you see this comedian, you see the dancers, and do they do sketches too?
I'm sure they did sketches. They did a bit of boring, warbling singing. That never appealed to me. But
you knew you wanted to be on stage.
Yeah. And then I saw an amateur production of Hamlet by the Southend Shakespeare Society.
Mm.
And that was really what That just completely blew me away. Not because it was a terrible production, I'm sure. You know, I do remember their tights all being sort of wrinkly around their ankles.
Yeah.
But the story, I was just so blown away by the story. And I mean, can you imagine that's why I don't think Shakespeare should be taught in schools. Can you imagine watching Shakespeare for the first time when you're about 13 or 14 and you don't know what happens? You don't know that Ophelia goes mad and dies. You don't know that Hamlet's going to come back. You don't know that they're all going to die. You have no idea of the story. So you watch it like a thriller because it is an incredible thriller.
Yeah, yeah.
And to have that thriller of watching, going, oh my God, what's going to happen next? With that poetry, with that those incredible conceptions, into, you know, thoughts in your mind at the same time. I mean, and that was sort of my experience.
Wow. Because I've been sort of this like ignoramus on my show over the years in terms of how I've been sort of unable to engage with Shakespeare in the way that a lot of people do. And I've told Shakespearean actors this, and like Ian McKellen sat.
Yeah, I know Ian very well. Yeah.
Yeah. He sat across from me and did Shakespeare to my face.
Of course he did. Of course he did. He would.
It was that monologue about immigrants, I think, the Thomas More? It wasn't.
Yes, I've heard him do that speech,
right,
actually.
Yeah.
Yes. Because it must have been around the time he was doing his one-man show, probably, was it? But that's wonderful. But
he just,
yes,
like, and it connected with me because my problem is, maybe it's as an American or maybe just as a person, you know, because I enjoy being engaged, but I do get a little lost with the language and it becomes difficult for me to sort of follow the story.
Totally. The language can be very, very, it is very difficult. But with a great production and great actors, that clarifies an awful lot of it, you know.
So that's what happened to you. You were 13 and you were just, you know, your mind was blown.
My mind was blown by the story as much as anything. It's a fabulous world. It was so different from my boring little, you know, little dormitory town I felt that I was living in, you know, suburban street and all the rest of it. And to see, so that engaged my imagination and I became quite obsessed at that point with not so much with the intellectual stuff of Shakespeare, but just the stories and the characters.
And you'd already you wanted to be on stage, you knew that. And
I didn't know that, but I knew I wanted to imaginatively live in these other worlds.
Oh, so this was before the End of the Pier thing?
No, after the End of the Pier thing.
So you got
the
both sides. Thing,
exactly.
The burlesque, yeah. And then you got Hamlet.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of me in a nutshell, actually.
There you go.
There you go.
Figured out the source of your being.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you slowly, you know, engage with the process of becoming a theater
person? Becoming an actor? Well, I went to a teacher's training college because I couldn't afford to go to drama school.
Uh-huh.
But there was a teacher's training college where
you're going to learn to be a teacher. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was a hopeless teacher. I mean, I was so hopeless, useless.
Do you want to be a mother? Do you want to be a teacher? It's good.
No,
you know your limitations.
I didn't want to be a teacher. But there was this great organization called the National Youth Theatre in Britain that allowed kids who didn't come from a financially, you know, supportive background, could go and in your summer holidays, you went and did theatre.
Yeah.
And that sort of launched me. I did Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra with that organization, and it, you know, the press would come. That was a great thing. That, you know, the critics from the newspapers would come. So they gave me a good press, and from that moment on, I went to the Royal Shakespeare Company.
So that's where you actually trained because you just had a knack?
Yeah.
You had a knack for it? Is that what you would say?
Well, you know, it's like any, it's like a lot of jobs, isn't it? Really, you can't really train. What you can do is practice. Training is, and you can practice and be guided in your practice. And I'm sure that's the same with music and with art, painting.
Right. So the essential, so the ideas of practice then are, how do I connect, you know, this text to who I am or to what's necessary to make
exactly.
it convincing.
Exactly. And I was lucky that I was being, in a sense, being paid, not very much, but being paid to practice and to learn with the Royal Shakespeare Company. But I was kind of in at the deep end. You know, I started off, boom, you know, at quite a high level.
Why is that? Because they, you just had, you, because you were, you had a natural gift, I guess.
I guess. Yes. and also, and a drive. And the gift is one thing. The drive is the most important, isn't it? Don't you think, Mark, in life, you know, you see incredibly gifted people wasting their gifts because they don't have the drive. And then you see less gifted people with incredible drive, and right. they do better.
A lot of times the gifted people who don't have the drive, it's just that they have it. It's just going into them. They're driving themselves into the wall of their heart.
Yes. No, absolutely. And it's tragic when you see that happen.
It is.
It's devastating.
It is.
On the other hand, you see another kid, you know, who just their imagination has been engaged by something, and they are just absolutely driven to do this. And I, you know, that's what art is. It's the drive. Really.
But it's not like, it's interesting because now, you know, ambition and drive can be applied to different things, but the drive you're talking about is not, it's not a career drive. It's a passion.
Oh no. It's not a career drive at all.
Right.
No.
It's a passion to be fully immersed in the thing.
It's the creative passion, absolutely.
Yeah. So who are the people you were working with? Would I know any of them?
Who are my contemporaries? quite a lot of them have died.
Oh, have they?
Mike Lee, the film director.
I've been watching his movies.
Mark,
oh, my God.
Yes, Mike Lee was an assistant director. Mark Rylance was in the, I'm sure you know who Mark is. He was one of the young actors that in my group.
That's interesting. I didn't know that about Mike Lee. So he was what was his role in the Royal
Shakespeare? He was an assistant director. He was in the directorial world, but he was an assistant director. And in fact, we saw him aside from the RSC, but in his own, you know, in his own time, start with experimenting on this sort of improvisational theatre, or theatre that was written out of improvisation.
Huh.
So
he was doing that.
He was doing that way back then. Absolutely.
Have you done any work with him?
No, I've never worked with Mike. I know him because, you know, being
that seems crazy to me.
Contemporaries, but I've never worked with him. No.
How are you at the How are you at the improvising? Are you any good? Can you do it?
Sometimes I'm really good at it, and sometimes I'm unbelievably naff. You know what naff means?
I feel like because of how you used it, I know what it means.
Yeah, naff means daft.
Yeah.
But not very good. But maybe that's the nature of improvisation. But Americans are brilliant at improvisation.
Yeah, some of them.
Americans
are
much freer. I think the Brits are getting freer because I think they've learned from the Americans.
Oh, well,
and
finally.
I think the whole, finally, exactly. It took them a long time. But
you've addressed that. It's sort of interesting that you've, you know, I'm jumping around a bit, but that, you know, the sort of, I rewatched The Queen as well, which you won the Academy Award for. I watched it the other night, and that's a really amazing performance on your part. But it's a great story, and it's a really great script to sort of figure out, you know, how to capture that woman as a human, you know, and in what situations. You know, it's just really kind of a brilliantly constructed movie.
Yes, Peter Morgan, a great writer.
Really, yeah, it was really something. Writer, yeah. But it sort of deals with that idea of, you know, how British people see themselves and, you know, how they think they're supposed to behave traditionally or nationally.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's of a certain generation,
yeah,
obviously.
Right.
And I don't know how true that. I mean, I'm an Elizabethan in the sense that when I came into this world, Elizabeth was on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
No, she wasn't on the throne, but she was about. I was, I think, 6 or 7 when she was crowned.
Mm-hmm.
And she may well outlive me, I don't know, but she will have been the queen for the whole of my life, you know.
Yeah.
She has been the monarch of Britain. And I think, you know, that as we were talking earlier about my parents' generation, that generation of people, of which the queen is very much a part of that generation.
Yeah.
It's amazing that she's still there. So we can see that generation still alive and still committed to their sense of values and that, you know, to be criticized sometimes, but
yeah,
but also to be admired in many ways.
Yeah, there was some great stuff in that movie between you and what's his name, Michael, or the who played Blair?
Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen. Yes, fantastic.
I mean, really, yeah, something else, and yeah, you know, it's fresh in my head. Obviously, I know you did it a long time ago.
Thank you for watching. That's very sweet of you.
And
doing your homework.
Well, you know, it's like you know, there's not, you have such there's so much you've done. And there, you know, and for some reason, I chose to watch a bit of Catherine. I chose to watch Long Good Friday, and I chose to watch The Queen. I don't know why I chose.
That's a good mix.
And then
that's a good mix.
And I actually, yeah, I watched a couple of clips from Hero Stratus.
That's unfair. That's unfair. I was at college when I did that. I was a student film that I,
yeah,
stupidly signed up for when I was like 18 years old.
I didn't know what it was. I was trying to figure out just how.
It's amazing. It's still around. It's very. It's very alarming.
Well, I don't think you can't. They don't have the whole movie on YouTube, I don't think. And I think it's someone has reprinted it and made it available. I was just curious in terms of, you know, in that time, in the late 60s, early 70s, when there was so much kind of creative and adventurous things going on, you know, in theater and in film or whatever. I was more curious about, you know, what
no,
you were involved
right.
in.
It was a period of you know, the whole 60s thing was an incredible sort of explosion in so many ways, politically,
yeah,
you know, artistically.
Yeah. So that's what I was looking at. I wasn't looking at it to make fun of you or anything. I was curious.
The embarrassment tapes.
No,
yes.
No. So, like, before I forget, do you know, and I'm sure you've answered this question before because I'm sure you did press junkets and it was on every one of them. Do you know how the Queen, did she say anything about your performance?
No, she never directly said anything. She wouldn't. I did meet her afterwards.
You
she
did.
Very kindly. Oh, I did. I had met her very briefly before.
Uh-huh.
But she very kindly, and this was basically a tick. She invited me for tea.
Wow.
To have tea. No, not at I was at Ascot. I had been asked to give a prize at Ascot. So I probably as a stand-in for the Queen, really. But she was there because she goes to Royal Ascot. And she asked me to go and have tea.
What is Ascot?
Ascot is a race thing,
okay,
you know,
okay,
a horse race
okay,
thing.
Okay, all right.
Horse race meeting.
Got it, yeah.
It's the biggest, poshest horse race meeting in Britain, Royal Ascot. And the Queen goes, because as you know, she's a huge horse aficionado.
Right.
That's her passion. That's her drive is horses. Not monarchy, actually, although she does it so well.
So she asked you for tea?
She asked me for tea.
Yeah.
And she introduced me to some sheikh that was there as well, as this is Dame Helen. Because I was made a dame before I played the Queen, funnily enough. But this is Dame Helen. She played me, you know, in the film. And the sheikh looked completely confused because he obviously hadn't seen or heard of the film. So,
but you know, she watched it.
But she never said anything. And I never would have expected her to. Why should she? You know, that's the great thing about that kind of monarchy, is that they just let us get on with it.
Uh-huh.
They get, you know, they get criticized, they get mocked.
Right.
They get, and they just say nothing.
Well,
just...
when you do that character, or like, I mean, and this is a question I wanted to go back and ask also about Shakespeare. You know, I have to assume, even though you seem to want to approach acting, you know, it's a craft, it's a skill, it's something you practice, but there are things revealed to you through the process. I mean, you must take something away from, you know, figuring out how to play the queen with a full sort of strata of human emotions. You know, doesn't it have an effect on your life?
Yeah, I mean, what we do as artists, if, in any of the arts, you know, is that we are constantly re-examining what it is to be human, aren't we? I mean, just constantly, musicians do that, painters do that, writers do that, and certainly actors do that. It's a constant re-examination of what it is to be human in all these different contexts. So, you know, playing the queen, it's very interesting because she lives in a bubble that none of us can comprehend.
Yeah.
Except for, I guess, some other monarchs somewhere else in some other country. Mm. But this, you know, Jeff Bezos doesn't live in that kind of bubble.
Yeah, no.
You know, it's a very specific, and the weight of history.
Right.
Bubble.
The context of traditions that have to be.
The context of, absolutely, and that you are one of a long, long line, and the formality, and all of the shit, and the spoiledness of it, and the fact that no one, can you imagine this? No one has ever not laughed at one of your jokes ever in your life since you were 15.
Right.
If you cracked anything that was even mildly amusing, you know, people laugh. I mean,
Did you use that? Like, is that an observation that sort of gave you some sort of entry into... her.
No, you know what I did? I only looked at film of her before she was queen when I was doing my research. I just looked at her
when she was a little girl,
to the age of when she was a little girl, especially just to see who is this character, who is this person inside this huge, weighty thing that's is in her and entrapping her.
Uh-huh.
Who is that person inside of there? So I looked at film of her as a little girl a lot, as much as I could find. There wasn't a lot out there, and then anything up to and stuff of her during the war, when she was very happy during the war because she could work on cars, you know.
Yeah.
and be in the women's forces. I think she was very happy there.
Uh-huh.
Just this practical, slightly unimaginative probably, but very, very dutiful, very dutiful, disciplined, but kind. You see her with Princess Margaret. She's always sort of encouraging her and helping her. So there's a great kindness there, I thought. So I just sort of, you know, came towards what I thought was this real person inside of this extraordinary bubble she's in.
That's great. It's sort of, I don't know, because like I would assume, but I didn't grow up with, you know, with her my whole life as a queen, that, you know, she would want to say something, but you would never expect her to say anything about your portrayal of her.
No, I wouldn't have ever expected that. No, or asked for it, or no.
So I would assume that the way you were brought up with your father, that there was some criticism of the monarchy in the household.
Oh, yes. Oh, no, absolutely. My parents were strong anti-monarchists.
But you have a reverence that survived that for the monarchy?
No, I don't have a reverence for the monarchy.
Mm.
As Stephen Frears said, we're queenists.
Mm-hmm.
We're not monarchists. We're
right.
Queenists.
Oh, you like the queen.
I look at that woman and I appreciate and very much respect how she has conducted herself through all of this history, through all of these changes, cultural changes in the world that she has survived through. Imagine the massive cultural change she's experienced.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the loss of empire.
Yeah.
You know, before the Second World War, you know, she grew up in a world where, you know, Britain was a big empire and, you know, there was a power in the world. And she has witnessed the demise of that completely. But the way she's conducted herself, she never got fat. She never got thin. She never, you know, became addicted to anything. She just steadily went on, you know, through and then through Diana and all the stuff that family-wise she's had. Andrew, oh my God, Andrew. So, you know, but she will, like this amazing sort of ship, just carrying on all through all the storms.
And what do you think, like, in terms of, like, because you did a lot of Shakespeare before you did films, right? I mean, when you were younger.
Yes, yes.
Now, like, as an artist, you know, how does that, because Shakespeare pretty much covers the full spectrum of human goodness and horror. Like, you know,
yes, it does. From Tamburlaine or, you know, Lear, Gloucester's eyes being put out.
Right.
He was unafraid of horror. Yeah.
And so, like, I have to, like, in terms of your education as a grown up and as somebody who investigates the human emotional capacity, it's all in Shakespeare, right? It's all there. So you've had to, like, the part of that training, whether it's about acting or movement or being here or there on the stage, emotionally, you're going to get filled up with almost every type of interaction possible between humans doing Shakespeare.
Yes. The only issue there is the language.
Right.
As you said, so you are fighting. You're not fighting the language because the language is so poetic and beautiful and supports emotion, but it's trying to get the audience to understand what you're talking about, you know, sometimes.
But when it was written, that wasn't an issue?
No, I would imagine not.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I would imagine not. Well, certainly a lot easier, although he was still writing poetically. And there are still poetic conceits that you have to sort of follow through and understand the ultimate sort of bringing together of that conceit.
So you spend this time doing Shakespeare and doing some other classics and some modern theater. And then, you know, the desire is to do film, which it seems is a much, in most cases, unsatisfying and lesser, you know, venture. Like, you know, did you feel that after doing the work you did on stage, the first few films you had was sort of like a letdown? Like, I mean, is it really the type of acting?
No, it's not the acting. I think that if there was anything there, it was just the thinness and the paucity of the thought in a scene. You know, when you're used to these sort of incredibly profound thoughts that you have to engage in Shakespeare. I mean, the simplest version of that is to be or not to be. That is the question. And, you know, when you're having to think that, unfortunately, I've never played Hamlet. I would love to have played Hamlet. Just that concept is so profound, you know. And then you're in a movie and you say, you know, where's the milk?
Yeah.
or you know,
right.
Remember to shut the door, or, you know, or I kill people, dear.
Right.
The acting in film is very intense and very powerful, because it's like this unbelievable concentration. It concentrates down, And, you know, you've got this huge set and all these hundreds of people and everyone's arrived. The light guys arrived at 4 a.m. and the honey wagon people drove the honey wagon in and the catering got set up and the makeup truck is there. And then you're in makeup at 6 a.m. And now all of that stuff. And now is action. And now it's your job to do everything, the thing that all of this is about. All of those people's work, everything, the time, the effort is all down to action.
That's your job.
And that's my job.
And you don't know how that's going to be cut.
And I don't know how it's going to be cut. I don't know how it's going to come out even.
I know.
Because you don't practice, you can't rehearse it. So it's I find film acting incredibly intense and wonderful and demanding and inspiring. And I watch Americans do it. And the first time I worked with Americans, I was blown away by them because their ability to be natural within this unspeakably unnatural. It's more natural to be on a stage, honestly, with another person opposite you in costume and you know, than it is on any film set. It's almost impossible to be natural. And so the people who are natural and within their naturalness are inventive.
Who was the first person that you noticed that with, that you worked with when you were like, oh my God?
Well, I have to say Pacino was the greatest master of that. The master of the technique completely.
Did you work with him?
I did. I did a TV thing about Phil Spector.
Oh yeah, that was way right.
I played his lawyer and he played Phil. Yeah. But to work with Al is an amazing experience. But one of the actors that I worked with on the first American film I did, which was 2010, was Bob Balaban. I don't know if you've ever spoken or
Met
Bob Balaban, a great actor and a great guy.
I've talked to him,
and he gave me this brilliant piece of film acting note, and I've passed this on to other young actors. And at the time, a book called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance was very fashionable. And he said, acting is like Zen. He said, you aim your arrow where you think it's going to land, you know, in the take, aim your arrow and let it go. And let it go, let it land wherever it lands, because you can't control where it lands. You can't control what the audience are going to get from that moment. That is, you don't even know whether it'll be in the movie or not. So aim your arrow, give it all you can, and then let it go.
Yeah.
Don't go home and think, oh my God, I should have done it like this. I should have done it like that. Why didn't I do that? Which one tends to do in film. So it was a great piece of
That is
advice.
Great. That's something. Yeah, I mean, you worked with him on where'd you work with Bob?
This was 2010. He was in 2010.
Oh, the movie 2010,
and then,
right.
Yeah, the movie 2010. And then, yes, he was a producer on Gosford Park as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he's great. He's a great
lovely,
guy.
Lovely, smart, wonderful guy.
It is interesting, though, that you're saying that it's more natural to be on stage because of the context. It's like, I'm going to talk to that guy. We know exactly what we're going to say, and this is how it goes.
And this is how it goes. And you've got chairs to sit on, and you know, and you're in your sure, there's an audience out there, and you are sort of incorporating them. But with on film, people often say, what's it like to work with Bruce Willis? Well, I know what it's like to be with Bruce Willis, and it's a lovely thing, incidentally, to be with Bruce Willis. He's so kind and lovely. But to act with him, you're not acting, you're acting with the camera. You know, you're looking at a thing on the side of the camera. You're not looking at a person in general.
Right. And also, that's it. You're servicing an illusion film and television. Whereas in theater, you're not. Theater, everyone understands the terms, this is the play. This is the theater.
Yes.
They're going to do the thing. And if they do it well, we're going to be elevated and taken out. With film.
And you live in the world. You're living
in
the world. I mean, you step onto that set.
Yeah.
You're in the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But on a film set, it's hard to, I can understand the actors who just want to stay. They have to stay in that world.
Right.
Even though they're in their trailer or their, craft services, they're in that world. Don't talk to me. I can only answer as Lincoln. I can understand that because, film is the film world.
It's easy. It's easy. It's easy to
so distract.
Right. So have you worked with those kind of guys? Was Pacino like that?
No, he wasn't like that. No.
He's also one of those guys, like he's one of those method guys, those second generation method guys that can really, when he wants to, he can really still do it. There's a couple of them, De Niro's still great too, but Pacino can really get lost in something.
Oh, totally. Yeah, I thought he was brilliant in. Yeah, I thought he's brilliant in the recent Scorsese film.
Oh yeah, yeah, Jimmy Hoffa.
I thought he was fantastic.
You know what he's great in is that Kevorkian movie on HBO.
I haven't seen that. I'd love to see that.
He's great in that. I mean, that was to me.
He's one of the great thing about Pacino was when he was off camera, and he would always do everything off camera for you. But he wouldn't just say the lines. He wouldn't be reading the lines, or just full out acting. He'd give a more of a performance sometimes off screen than he would on screen because he'd be inspired by something. He can't stop himself.
Loves to act.
He loves it. He loves it. He loves the imaginative process.
But it's very generous for somebody to do.
Incredibly.
So in the beginning though, did you find that you were taken, where do you see the evolution from? Cause at the beginning you had smaller parts. There were some sort of slightly, sexualized parts where you expected to fill, a role that had nothing to do with necessarily the character or who you were. And so you kind of evolved out of that somehow. I think it was probably, Long Good Friday was probably the first big,
Well, no, I would say the first big in a way. I mean, I'd done lots of big TV roles.
And at
that time, and it was true, British film is alive and well and living on television.
Uh-huh.
And that was very much the case sort of through the 70s.
Uh-huh.
But I did luck out majorly and get the role in Prime Suspect, which was a big...
Well, that was later. That was after.
That was later. Yeah. That was in the 80s, yes. But that allowed me to segue very nicely through that can be a difficult time for women, the late 30s, early 40s era period, when you're not the, cute young Barney anymore.
Right.
And you never will be again. And but you... all the time you've been looking for something more than that anyway. And Prime Suspect was a wonderful way for me to go into a different generation, a different kind of work.
Well, I mean, you did it for like a decade, didn't you? How long was that on?
Well, I did. It wasn't that it was on. I was very lucky because it wasn't like a TV series.
Yeah.
It was something that we did every 18 months. I would do another Prime Suspect. So in between, I would do theatre, I would do art movies, I would do lots of other things. It was never like a series, like an ongoing rolling series. It was never that. It was just every 18 months, I would do another Prime Suspect.
And you dug into that character. People knew the character. People were fans.
And followed along with her. She had her development, over the years.
And now when you do... you do a lot of different kinds of stuff and, you kind of show up in things and you are, everyone knows you. So you can just do something like documentary now and people are.
I love that. Yeah. Is it brilliant?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's great.
Is it brilliant? Don't you love it, Mark?
I do.
I love it. It's very, very fun.
Those guys are hilarious.
Yeah.
But do you see any difference in doing The Queen and Fast and Furious movie?
Yeah, of course it's different. It's completely different.
But do you
begged to be in Fast and Furious.
You did?
I begged. I was. Oh, yes. Yes, I begged.
Why? Why did you beg to be in that movie?
I don't know, because it was so different from the Queen, I think. And, you know, but I did get to, you know, I love driving cars. Of course, then they never had me driving a car.
Oh, they let you drive one on set, though, didn't they?
Did eventually, they? Yes. Oh, good. Yes, all right. Eventually.
So that was a fun thing you did.
It was a fun thing, yes. Although you know, in all these fun things, there's always an element that's not so fun.
Yeah.
You know, because in the end, filmmaking is quite a serious business. It's
sure
financially serious, and it's a weighty thing. A movie.
There's expectations. You know.
Yeah, but Vin has become a great friend.
Oh yeah, you and Vin, you hang out.
Me and Vin, I love Vin. Yeah. We don't really hang out. We hang out on messages and things like that.
Uh huh. He seems like a good guy.
He's a good guy.
And he looks great on camera. That's the weird thing. There's some gift that certain actors have where you just like...
Absolutely. They have a power on camera.
It's wild.
There's an internal power that is undeniable.
And it's unexplainable, too. You can't manufacture it.
Unexplainable. And it's sort of not about acting. No. It's about something quite different.
You just fit.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. So playing Catherine, this four... What is it? You did it... Was it six or four episodes?
Four two-hour episodes.
So is there anything exciting about the Russian element, given that it's your history?
Well, you know, she actually wasn't Russian,
right,
was Catherine. She was Prussian.
Right.
Sort of German-Russian.
But she ran the store for a while.
But she ran the store for a long while. An amazing, amazing character that I had always been sort of fascinated by. Just anyone who is prepared, I guess, when people, and especially women of that era,
mm-hmm.
who just know that they have the capability to do this thing.
Yeah.
You know, so much of being a woman is actually about insecurity, questioning yourself, not feeling you're capable, because for maybe 1,000-odd years, we've been told that we are incapable and we can't do it. And, you know, of course, Mark, in the world of comedy,
sure.
When I grew up, women were not funny. Oh, no, women can't be funny. You know, we love women. They're lovely. They can do so many other things. They're wonderful. And in the end, they're stronger than men and they last longer than men, but they can't be funny. They're just not funny. It's just the way the world is, you know. And that was a completely accepted reality.
Well, yeah, they were. But even the way you said it, they're like the sort of framing of women in a broad sense, it's like, well, they're so great, they're so much stronger than we are, but they can't do anything
other than what we've let them do.
Yeah,
exactly, exactly. And you have witnessed the change
in
attitude
for sure.
And oh my God, women can be funny. In fact, they're really funny. They're brilliant.
Oh yeah, some of the best comedians right now are women for sure.
Oh, fantastic!
Maria Bamford is a genius.
Oh, I don't know Maria Bamford. Yeah, I must look her up.
Yes, she's.
Oh, great!
I'm always singing her praises. But yeah, and it's getting. I think it is getting a little better, you know, for women in comedy, and there is something to. It's definitely a fight to be fought, and they are fighting, and it's a righteous fight.
It's been a big breakthrough there. But anyway, for thousands of years, we were told that we were great, we were lovely and fabulous, but there are certain things we just can't do. So Catherine, in the 18th century, looks at a complicated, violent, difficult country like Russia, and says, I can do this at the age of 25 or so.
It's crazy to think that, right?
It's crazy to think that. And before that, she'd learnt Russian. She had, learnt the politics of court. I mean, she was just so brilliant.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she was very accessible. She was sexual. She loved falling in love. You know, she wasn't this sort of, you know,
right.
You know, one-dimensional person. She had all these layers of femininity about her as well. So I'd always been sort of fascinated about this character.
And also she was like a rebel to a degree in terms of, you know, shifting the feudal culture into something more.
Well, trying to in the early days of her reign, if you could call it that. Yes, she tried to liberate. She was inspired by Voltaire and the ideas that were coming out of France that, of course, led to the French Revolution. But the reality of the power structure, the financial structure in Russia, depending upon the serfs, the feudal system, was just too, she couldn't dislodge it. She was not, and in the end, actually, she became quite, as radicals often do, you know, they become quite conservative and quite, she was fairly tyrannical towards the end, as I guess she got older and she was fighting to sort of
hold on to power. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that these, because there's a lot of them in the arts too, these former kind of liberal, kind of progressive, somewhat, you know, radical creative forces, you know, eventually become older and much more conservative.
I wonder. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Of the reasons I was so joyful, I'm not joyful to see people out there without masks on, but to see the protests recently, it's like, yes, thank God, the young are back.
Yeah.
You know, the young are doing what the young have to do. That's their job in life. Their job,
fighting for change,
as a young person, is to fight for change and to be the ones with the courage and the balls and the tenacity and the energy to get up there and be out there and with their, you know, their signs. So I was, you know, just so great to see that happen. The millennials didn't do that. You know, there was a weird generation where they just wanted to make money. And that always slightly disturbed me. But then the natural progression as you, I guess, you get married, unlike you and I, you have children, you get a mortgage, you have a garden, you want to plant, you know, and other things come in. But it is the role of the young.
Sure. I understand getting practical, but and I understand maybe getting fiscally sort of like in your own personal life, more conservative, but I don't really understand these guys who were, you know, real artists at one time becoming sort of malignantly socially conservative. It's some sort of, I don't know what it is. It's a wiring that they got.
You probably don't want to say a name, but give me a name.
David Mamet, John Voight.
Oh, yes. Yes. Interesting. True. I don't think John Voight was ever radical. I think he was always conservative.
Oh,
Mamet, I agree.
Maybe I'm just thinking about his roles. Yeah.
Yes, I think.
I don't know. I talked to Jane Fonda. I talked to Jane Fonda.
Yes.
And I think he took a big turn. A lot of these guys took a turn after 9/11. Something just broke in their brain and they decided that foreigners were terrible and that, you know, America was under assault.
Mark, I completely agree. I can't comprehend that.
Yeah. I think it's what happens is it's that there's a sensitivity necessary to be a genuine artist. And I think that, you know, if you get older and you maintain that sensitivity and at some point you become consumed with fear that you can't get back to it anymore and you react in a different way.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I've worked with both of them. You know, Mamet wrote the... Phil Spector piece.
Which one?
And Phil Spector.
Oh,
he wrote and directed it.
He's like I think he likes being a button pusher. Like he's a
I think that's true.
But I think he means
I think he's a provocateur.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes, he is. And I don't think John Voight is. I think I worked with John on National Treasure. He played my husband.
Oh, really?
You know, both obviously Mamet is really, really smart, but John is also very, you know, intelligent.
Yeah.
It's a bit like what's his name? The other, you know, my cold dead hand,
Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston,
yeah.
Who I met, very articulate.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want these people to be smart and articulate. You want them to be kind of, you know, like Trumpish.
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But they're not. They're very smart, very articulate. But you know, oh my God, the arguments are so
They're just not
dangerous and unpleasant and
closed off, not embracing, not tolerance.
No tolerance. Mm. No. Yes.
Yeah, it's a fear thing.
And frightening.
Yeah, they're frightened. These boomers who are coming up on the end of their time, they kind of their egos freak out.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. It's hard to explain.
But I don't understand it either.
But they were nice to you.
They were very nice to me, both of them. But I would argue with them.
Oh, good.
I did argue with them.
Oh, good.
I didn't take it.
Good.
I argued.
Well, keep it up.
Yeah.
It was great talking to you, Helen.
You too, Mark. Thank you. Thank you. I was told it would be fun, and it was fun. It was great.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Helen Mirren. How great was that? There were moments there where I'm like, I think I love her. You didn't hear it because maybe I got you locked into me screaming in my heart, but my heart was singing a bit talking to Helen Mirren, and you can watch her in Catherine the Great, now streaming or on demand on all HBO platforms. She's also in the one and only Ivan, which will be on Disney Plus next month. And now I will play some guitar. I got to learn some new chords. How long have I been saying that? How long? My heart is screaming. I'm screaming inside my heart. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.